From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young at WFSU in Tallahassee.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. We're following the latest on the suspected mail bomb sent to prominent Democrats and critics of President Trump. We are also watching the stock market, which bounced back at the open today after a rough day yesterday. The stock market has dropped about 10% this month. We are joined now by Alan Greenspan, who is the Federal Reserve Chairman from 1987 to 2006, co-author of the new book Capitalism in America, A History. Alan Greenspan, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you.
And I want to start with just what's going on right now, what everybody's paying attention to, which is what do you think is going on in the stock market at the moment?
There are more sellers than buyers to start with.
Yeah.
But the question, more seriously, it's essentially the movement of long-term interest rates moving higher and concurrently the wage rates are being pressured, but mainly interest rates is creating this fairly significant adjustment. Typical, not unexpected, but whenever you get the spread between the 5-year Treasury note and the 30-year bond opening up, which is what has happened, you have a significant impact on stock prices.
But this is not a big surprise to anybody. The Fed has been saying for a long time that interest rates were eventually going to go back up again. Why do you think the market is reacting like this?
Well, I think it's basically the combination of not what the Fed is doing, which, remember, is short-term interest rates. Mm-hmm. It's what the market itself is doing for the 10-year Treasury note and, say, the 30-year Treasury bond. They've moved up significantly, and that's where the major business decisions are determined, out at that scale. In other words, 10 years, 15 years out, not overnight, which is largely where the Fed comes from.
Is there anything that the government can do about this, either through monetary policy or fiscal policy? Or should they do anything or just let things happen as they do?
Well, we're in the process of adjustment, and we've had interest rates in this country at the lowest level in American history. We're now coming out of it and gradually adjusting. So long as long-term interest rates, which, as I said, is a critical factor, continue to rise, the pressure is going to be downward on stock prices. But it's very difficult to say where it goes from here because pundits have been right half the time.
Well, and President Trump has been saying that interest rates should stay low, that the Fed is moving too quickly.
I was in the Federal Reserve and elsewhere for more than 20 years, and I got innumerable requests to cut interest rates from everybody, including the politicians, and especially the presidents of the United States. In all of that time, I never got any communication saying, please raise rates. So what's occurring currently is merely an extension of the past. I don't know a single president, incidentally, and I worked for a lot of them, who don't want lower interest rates. Now, obviously, that's not possible. If you keep lowering them down to zero, where do you go from there?
Right. Do you think that the tax cuts have had their impact on the economy, or can they still give it a boost at this point?
Well, the tax cuts really are very interesting in the sense that they look like the tax structure change that Ireland made back in the 1990s, where they went from a top corporate rate of 35% down to 12%, and that's essentially what we did. It has had a positive effect. It changes the calculation on corporate investment, and you can see the figures are moving. I would say, put it this way, that the impact has been really quite significant, but it's already completed.
And obviously, it's not over when it comes to what it's adding to the deficit. Are you concerned about that, about how much these tax cuts will add to U.S. debt?
Very much so. But remember this, deficits as such have very little impact on policy, but what does is inflation. mean, for example, in I think it was August 1971, President Nixon put on wage and price controls when the inflation rate was 4%. So it's not the deficit that's going to create a problem. It's the consequences of the deficit. All deficit of the size we're looking at now eventually impact their way onto the price level. It's only then that history tells us the political system gets sufficiently galvanized to do something about it.
What would you advise people as they watch the ups and downs of the stock market right now, and probably they have some investments in their retirement account or even they're investing in everyday things in the market?
I've been around long enough to know don't answer that question.
Alan Greenspan, the former chairman of the Federal Reserve. Next week, you can hear more of our conversation about interest rates, immigrant labor, and whether he and the Fed were partly to blame for the 2008 financial crisis.
Well, one of the high-profile midterm elections we've been following is the governor's race in Georgia. The Democrat Stacey Abrams is vying to become the country's first African-American female governor. Her Republican opponent is the current Secretary of State, Brian Kemp. And for both parties, the governor's race is only a small part of a larger strategy to expand their bases. And Democrats say they're making their largest ever effort to turn Georgia into a blue state. Georgia Public Broadcasting's Stephen Fowler reports.
Hi, how are you today?
I'm doing all right.
It's a sunny Saturday, and about a dozen people are huddled in Amanda Tate's living room about an hour northwest of Atlanta. Tate chairs the Gordon County Democratic Party, and she's helping the state party expand its reach ahead of the midterms.
My house is the headquarters, typically, and I get volunteers to come here. We train them on phone banking and canvassing, and then we all go out and do what we're supposed to do.
The campaign prints flyers touting the Democrats' policies. It's come up with a unified message to highlight down-ballot races and built a voter outreach infrastructure to help Tate and her volunteers know who to target.
Great. I'm volunteering today on behalf of Stacey Abrams for governor and Sarah Riggs Amico for lieutenant governor and John Barrow for secretary of state.
Gordon County isn't a Democratic stronghold. 80% of its voters picked President Trump in the 2016 election, and Republican turnout was strong in this May's primary. But Amanda Tate says she's met plenty of closet Democrats who think they are the only ones around.
I get to tell them, no, you're not. There's several more on the street. We're growing. You should come to our meetings. You know, we need more people like you who are supportive of candidates.
Those closet Democrats, as well as citizens who don't normally vote, are the people this campaign is hoping can move Georgia to Democratic control. At this year's state party convention, thousands of people packed an Atlanta ballroom to rally around Abrams' gubernatorial bid and support the party's other nominees for office. State Democratic Party Executive Director Rebecca DeHart said the strategy is to target traditionally Democratic areas like Metro Atlanta and also dig into Republican strongholds like Gordon County.
We are organizing in areas that we've never been in. We are doubling down in areas where we know there are more votes. We are knocking on more doors. We are making more calls. We are sending more texts.
Georgia Democrats say they have 17 offices, 150 staff members, and thousands of volunteers across the state, and their efforts are getting national support. During the last fundraising cycle, the state party raked in nearly $6 million from individuals and PACs across the country. And Democrats with eyes on the White House in 2020 have made campaign stops here. Colorado Governor John Hickenlooper knocked on doors east of Atlanta. Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren spoke at a packed strip mall, and New York Senator Kirsten Gillibrand worked a phone bank in a bakery.
Hello, hi. My name is Kirsten Gillibrand, and I'm volunteering on behalf of Stacey Abrams for governor.
It's Sarah not a one-sided effort. The state Republican Party's campaign has seen visits from Vice President Mike Pence and Donald Trump Jr., and statewide candidates like gubernatorial nominee Brian Kemp are using Republicans' incumbency to strengthen their get-out-the-vote efforts.
We have campaigned in the primary and in the runoff in all parts of our state, and we're going to do the same thing in the general election. There is nowhere that we won't go to get votes and to have a winning coalition.
Audrey Haynes runs the Applied Politics Program at the University of Georgia. She says the amount of coordination between both state parties and their candidates is the highest it's ever been and will probably continue past the 2018 midterms.
The circumstances around the election, coupled with polarization, coupled with the nationalization of the campaigns, has increased the need for perhaps the party to be involved.
Polls show Abrams in a tight race with Kemp. In addition to the governor's mansion, Republicans control both chambers of the Georgia legislature and all 12 statewide elected offices. But for Democrat Amanda Tate, success won't be decided by election results alone.
I want to see a great turnout. I want to see people voting who haven't voted before, like young people or people who just weren't registered to vote for whatever reason. I want to see every Democrat in Gordon County getting out.
Early voting numbers are encouraging. In-person and absentee mail-in data show many more Georgians are casting their ballots than the previous midterms in 2014. For Here and Now, I'm Stephen Fowler in Atlanta.
While here in Tallahassee, Florida, we wanted to see how T.J. Ward was doing. You might remember T.J. We spoke just after Hurricane Michael landed on his hometown of Apalachicola, which sits where the Apalachicola River runs into the Apalachicola Bay and out to the Gulf of Mexico. His family's five-generation oyster and seafood business in its path.
I haven't been able to get out on the water to see if I have anything left. I haven't even been able to get to our oyster house, which is 13 miles from Apalachicola on the coast, to see if it even exists because it sticks out like a sore thumb.
So, this week we drove down to Apalachicola, a charming town of a little over 2,000, a mix of fishermen and cafes and art galleries, and it got cluttered. On Water Street, generators hum outside TJ's block-long family business, Buddy Ward and Sons Seafood, which looks like it's spilled its guts out on the street. Muddy equipment, fishing gear piled to the curb.
Hello?
Inside, we found TJ's dad, the fourth generation Ward, Tommy.
Excuse me.
How y'all doing?
I'm good. Are you the famous Tommy Ward?
Nah, he's not here. That must be my son. Hey, Robin.
How are you doing?
Oh, well, we got a lot of work today. Yeah. Cleaning, scrubbing, bleaching. You know, you want it to be right. Yeah. You're handling food. You know, we're getting our water pumps. We got motors and everything to redo everything yesterday. I picked them up in Dothan. And
what's the worst problem when you say clean? Is it because all the bay water came up in here?
Mud and everything come in here. You know, contamination, you want to clean it. It's just got to be pressure washed, bleached. I mean, just a lot of work got to be done.
That work includes moving heavy industrial pallets and constantly spraying the mud-slicked cement floor. This processing plant opens out onto the bay. We can see buckled, broken docks and idle oyster boats. Hurricane Michael landed a punch here, but this was an industry already on its knees. There's the fierce water wars. Fresh water from the Apalachicola River flows from Georgia to Florida, and the Supreme Court recently agreed with Florida that Georgia takes too much, leaving less of the fresh water to lower the salt level in the bay and keep at bay the salt-loving creatures that prey on oysters. Then there are oil spills, over-harvesting, climate change, which brings severe droughts. There were once hundreds of boats pulling in thousands of pounds of oysters outside this processing plant. And because of the salt balance, they were considered the best tasting in the world, according to the New York Times. Now there are hardly any native oysters, and Tommy's son TJ has turned to aquaculture, growing baby oysters, or spat, without shells. But the Wards were also leading the fight to seed oyster shells with baby oysters and place them out in the bay to try to bring the native oyster reefs back. And now, Michael. Outside the plant, an exhausted Tommy Ward holds his stomach. He doesn't feel so good.
Oh, no, my gut's killing me.
What's that?
Stomach.
Your stomach?
Yes, there's just a lot to do, you know. Got to get it done. Just nerves, you know, just too much of the good stuff at one time.
Please take care of yourself, Tommy.
Oh, I am. We're going to come back bigger and better and stronger. We're going to be all right. Yeah. I'm already blessed.
I'm about ready to quit. And with that, this big, tough oysterman's face crumples.
Yeah. No words.
Oh, my kids are good.
Your kids are good, so you're good.
We are still looking for one of Tommy's kids, TJ, when we find Tommy's brother Walter, or Dacky as he's called, and TJ's wife Melanie at the family's 13-mile seafood mart, which lost about $500,000 of goods.
This is brutal.
Oh, yeah. We've went through it before. I mean, we went through it so many times. I've been down here 43 years, and...
But the hurricane damage is one thing, but it's like a body blow on top of the punches you'd already been getting because of the changing river. And we've gone through all the problems, the water that isn't coming down from Georgia and it's being battled over legally.
I mean, it's pretty much what we have here is big industry and government not really taking care of us down here. And, you know, kind of like I got a buddy who lives in Georgia that says, you know, the rain that falls in Georgia is Georgia water. But then when they get too much rain, they send it to us.
Down the river.
Yeah. And I know the people in Atlanta's got to have water to drink and bathe with, but they should have thought about this 40 years ago before Atlanta got as big as they are. You know, I mean, me and Tommy owns about 400 acres of oyster leases, and we spent tons of money about 6 years ago to, you know, plant our leases. But with the water we got coming down, it didn't work out. And I would have never thought when I was a kid that I was going to pay $80, $90 for a sack of oysters. The $80, $90, if you can get them.
In the 1800s, oysters were for poor people.
Oh, and I was poor. I wasn't in the 1800s, but, you know.
That's the mud on the street.
Yeah.
Well, you're working your butts off. We're watching everybody. Melanie, come on in here, TJ's wife. Do you ever think we can't do this anymore?
Sometimes, I mean, it crosses my mind, but with TJ being out on the water, when I get to go with him, it makes me happy. And to see the customers that have been coming here since we have been closed just to want to volunteer and help, you know, makes me really glad that we did come and do this, and I don't regret it.
But this is going to be pretty much over with in the next 10 years. You know, it's just a matter of time.
That's awfully sad.
Well, I mean, that's pretty much what it is. It's just a matter of time.
When you and Tommy watch TJ and Melanie here working so hard, we talked to TJ. He's like, this is my family. I'm going to keep this going. It's got to pull at your heart.
It does. But he'll be okay. Okay.
Lots of welling eyes. Yeah, lots of welling eyes.
Right.
Okay.
See ya.
Oh,
I know. It's about to make me cry. I gotta toughen up right now.
This has been tough.
It has really been tough. TJ just started an oyster farming business. Are the oysters there? Are we gonna have to start from rock bottom again? We have a baby on the way, so I mean, whew. It's tough. They hold back their tears a lot. I don't think I've ever seen Dacky tear up before, so that was a first for me. They're strong. They know what we need to do, and we're there to help them, and they know that.
Are you TJ?
Nice to meet you.
13 miles up the bay, we finally find TJ Ward at that oyster house he said he wanted to see after Michael. It's been in the family for over 100 years. Sitting out on the bay, as he said, surrounded by protected land, not another building in sight. It is gorgeous, and it is pretty much a complete loss.
Okay. Oh, boy. I mean, there's electrical sockets hanging down. This was, drywall gone?
This was actually center block walls. You see some of the remnants.
Oh, my God. A cement wall completely in pieces.
Yeah. Back here is where you would unload the oysters. But the oysters would come in off the dock here, and this is where you would weigh up the bags of oysters. And they would go into this washroom.
The oyster house right on the water is, of course, not insured, but TJ says they'll rebuild, maybe smaller, and he'll keep aqua farming oysters, growing the baby oysters called spat without shells, hanging them off poles out in the bay. But his dream is that a consortium of government agencies, colleges, private industry, create hatcheries where spat can be grown on old shells into oysters that filter the water and procreate and create reefs that provide barrier for storms and living space for other creatures.
Especially state universities that have the technology and the means and also the students to work with, you know, the Department of Agriculture and all to maybe figure out how to have a place close by to put spat on shell. And if they don't want to do it as a statewide, maybe help private industry learn how to do it around, because we're not really familiar with that as much as other places like the East Coast here. I mean, we haven't needed to have a hatchery until just recent years, so.
Well, that's one answer. This isn't a factory that can move. This is part of an ecosystem. And if this is going, the Gulf is going, you know, because this is the fresh water from the river that goes through and helps take down the salt level in the Gulf.
Yeah, definitely. And I'm glad you said that, because a lot of people think with this water war that it's only about oysters. It's far from just being about oysters. It's a nursery for the Gulf.
Five generations. I mean, what's it like for you to watch those who've been struggling even longer than you? We saw your dad, Tommy. He looks hit hard.
It's hard to see your dad hurt. I feel like he still stays pretty strong, and you learn from them. When you feel like you're down, you look and see that they've gone through a lot too, so it makes you tough and try to stay tough for them as well. So,
but I see your eyes.
Yeah. I mean, it's tough for everybody.
You could leave. You and your wife both studied other things and then came back to do this and be part of the family. You could.
I've left before and came back, and then I left again, and I still come back. So it's just like, why leave knowing I'm going to come back? Just a great place. So it's just, I feel like it's no reason to leave again.
I'll just come back.
That's T.J. Ward at his family's Oyster House, just 13 miles from their 13-mile seafood market in Apalachicola, Florida, where town officials pledge the annual Seafood Festival will take place this year, first weekend of November, as usual. The Wards will be there.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Investigators say suspicious packages sent to actor and Trump critic Robert De Niro and former Vice President Joe Biden are similar to the crude pipe bombs that had been sent to former President Obama, Hillary Clinton, and other Trump critics. Joining us now is Phil Ewing, NPR National Security Correspondent. Hi, Phil.
Hi, Jeremy.
And what more do we know at this point about these packages?
Well, the FBI says there were two of them addressed to the former Vice President, Joe Biden. They were discovered at a mail facility in Delaware, which, of course, is his home state. And then early this morning, the New York Police Department was called about one delivered to a restaurant, a kind of business address that De Niro uses for his operations in that part of Manhattan. And that brings the total number of these suspected devices to 10 across a number of Democratic or Democratic-linked targets, all of whom are political nemesis of President Trump.
One of the things we do know is that there are no stamp cancellation marks on some of these packages, which means these bombs may have been hand-delivered. Is that something investigators are watching?
They are. They're looking at everything, although it's not as clear-cut as that might initially make it sound, because some of these suspicious packages were discovered at a mail processing facility, the ones that we know about that were addressed to the former vice president. Mm-hmm. So some of them have been traveling through the mail. Others may have been hand-delivered, like the one that arrived at CNN's office in New York City on Wednesday. And so there may have been a mix of methods used to try and deploy these things to these various addressees. But the Postal Inspection Service, the FBI, the Secret Service, they're looking into how these things got where they were supposed to go, in addition to whoever sent them and what they contained.
Are you hearing anything about why none of these have exploded so far?
No, except that we know one of them was protectively detonated by an explosive ordnance disposal team in New York. It was addressed to the billionaire liberal financier George Soros, and a bomb squad responded and protectively blew it up, just to be confident. What our correspondents understand from law enforcement sources today is that the materials from that detonation are being used in this investigation. So whatever substances, whatever chemistry and other evidence that investigators can take from that package that was blown up, but again blown up by a bomb squad, not because it went off on its own, that's going to go into the subsequent investigation here. I should also mention the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, the ATF, is involved with this investigation as well, of course.
This has gotten very political very quickly. Last night in scripted remarks, the president said, let's get along. But this morning, he once again blamed the media, tweeting, the anger we see today in our society is caused by the purposely false and inaccurate reporting of the mainstream media. And this morning, the White House press secretary, Sarah Sanders, defended the president's response.
Day in, day out, there is a negative tone. 90% of the media attention around this president is negative, despite historic job creation, despite the fact that our economy is booming, despite the fact that...
Phil, what should we take from all of this?
Well, what appears to be the case is the president, the White House, have internalized some of the criticisms that have come in the past 24, 36 hours about the political rhetoric in the United States, its tone and its temper. And the position they're taking is, this isn't on us. This isn't about me, the president says. This is about the type of coverage that I get from TV networks, newspapers, and others. And if there's someone who's been inspired by this negativity, that's the cause, not because of anything Trump or the White House has said. That's what their argument is.
Phil Ewing, NPR National Security Correspondent, thank you.
Thank you.
It would be hard to visit Florida without talking about water. The state is grappling with toxic algae. It was just inundated by Hurricane Michael. And we've been looking at the Apalachicola River, which begins upstream in Georgia as the Chattahoochee. That everyone can agree on. But Florida and Georgia have been locked in a water war over Georgia's use of the fresh river water. In June, the Supreme Court agreed with Florida that the state does suffer ecological and economic harm from Georgia's overuse of the water. A special judge is still sorting it all out, which will take time. Why does this matter? Well, we've talked about how the local oyster industry has been devastated because of the lack of fresh water that balances the salty waters of the bay and the Gulf beyond. This week, we met up in Apalachicola with riverkeeper Georgia Ackerman from the nonprofit River Keepers Alliance. Generators humming, hurricane debris piled high.
So as we walk down Water Street, the never probably more appropriately named Water Street, you know, you were telling us that you came in this morning. What were your thoughts?
To see all the accumulated equipment. I was a former small business owner many, many years ago, and I just saw, when I saw this morning, the dollar signs to me, the cost, the economic cost of replacing all this equipment and insurance, rigmarole, and everything that they will have to go through to get this replaced so that they can be doing what they need to be doing.
I mean, we're seeing, you know,
economically,
air conditioning units, look, drawers, a bureau, wood everywhere.
There's all kinds of gear, office supplies, refrigeration, warehouse material,
bikes. It's just, it is pretty sad. And yet, is it also maybe a sign that, you know, they're cleaning up, they're getting back?
There's no defeat going on here.
It's so funny, we're walking over oyster shells as we head out. I'm looking out on this bay. It looks gorgeous. Can we describe it? What is the grass that's over there?
So we've got really healthy marshes throughout the Apalachicola Bay. That one of the protective factors in terms of talking about the storm that has come in, marshes protect from storm surge and flooding. So those are going to slow down wind and rain. Florida's oyster population, 90% of it was coming from the Apalachicola Bay, 10% of it nationwide, and that's changed dramatically over the past couple years. The oyster is an indicator species, right? It's a keystone species. If you have a healthy oyster population, the scientists will tell you, guess what? You're going to find out you've got healthy finfish, you've got healthy crabs, you got healthy shrimp. And so when you see this challenge with the oysters, guess what? You're going to probably find out you've got challenges going on with your other parts of your system.
Yeah. You're the river keeper. You're charged with the keeping of this river. Just your thoughts about the emotional importance of having a healthy river.
I would sound very selfish if I was to say I was the only person in love with this river and really get why it is incumbent upon us to protect it and take care of it. This is a one-of-a-kind place. I could rattle off all the special environmental ecological designations for you, but you can just walk around town and talk to people and ask them what the river and bay mean to them, and you will get many stories of why people love this place and are fiercely protective of it.
And they include scientists and researchers.
I would say do it in front of this thing.
We've retreated to the riverkeeper's office. A boat trip had to be called off because of bad weather. Dr. Felicia Coleman, director of Florida State's Coast and Marine Lab, her colleague Dr. Sandra Brook, and Roy Ogles, recently retired from the state's Department of Environmental Protection, join us. I start by asking Dr. Coleman that question we started with. Why do we care about this?
I'd say the most spectacular fishery collapses have occurred worldwide on rivers that have had tremendous rediversion of water.
Because that water, bringing all its nutrients,
absolutely,
is not coming down into the salinated water. And
it's not coming down anymore. So that's a really important component, I think, that's overlooked.
Well, and talk more about that, Dr. Brook, because it's not just that it's encouraging the fish growth, it's discouraging the growth of the creatures that might prey on things like oysters, like the conch, which like the saltier water.
Yes, when the balance of salt and fresh changes, then different things happen. The problem with salt water is that it encourages these marine predators such as oyster drills and ground conch.
Talk about these oyster drills. It sounds like a horror film. Dr. Brook, tell us more. They latch onto the oysters and they like suck them out?
They sit down on an oyster, and then all of a sudden the oyster hears this scrape, 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 and eventually they'll scrape through the shell and stick its proboscis in and basically consume the oyster from within, and there's not a whole lot the oyster can do about it. It is rather horrific, yes.
Yeah, check it out on YouTube. It's like a bad movie. What else can be done? I mean, some people wonder why the bay wasn't just shut down so that it could replenish.
Let's start with the bay and the ecosystem, because if we don't address the problems with the ecosystem, if we're constantly reacting, one of the things that happened in the wake of the oil spill was that the fishermen were allowed to go out and harvest all the oysters.
Because the fear was that the spill would come in and kill the oysters.
So then, a couple of years later, there was no broodstock left there to repopulate it. Think about the functions that oysters serve. This is beyond the economics. They clean water, but they also offer refuge for a number of juvenile species that live inside the crevices. They help protect it from storm surge. You can't have this industry without that resource. You can't have good seagrass beds without the oyster resource. You can't have high water quality. You've got to restore all those things, but you have to do it in a deliberate fashion. One of the problems with the bay over the last few decades has been reaction to the oil spill, reaction to water flow, planting culch out there. And if that culch is the oyster shell, what the larval oysters settle on, but distributing it without a plan, you might as well be casting it all into the wind.
What would you recommend? I mean, we haven't even mentioned climate change and the droughts that have been a part of the fresh water coming in from the river drying up. You say it has to be deliberate. What does it have to be?
There are particular types of research that could be done that could relatively quickly in the next couple of years make some very good decisions about how we restore the bay. The fishermen really understand what's needed, but they want their livelihood restored. So there's a tendency to go for whatever looks like the quickest fix. Closing the bay is probably not a terrible idea.
And I think you would find fishermen that fully support
that.
Do.
Well, Dr. Brook, I mean, yes, research and really a committed effort instead of throwing short-term solutions. What about a desalination plant?
I think there are more problems in the bay than just salinity. You know, they had the drought back in 2007 and 9, and since then we've had decent rainfall, but the oysters haven't come back. Usually when a system crashes, it's not just one thing. But there are also other factors in play. You know, the reefs, they're not as high as they used to be. We don't know where the larvae are coming from. What does the topography of the bay look like? You know, how much of the culch sits where it is. There's all these questions that will help us figure out a way of making it come back.
This is so interesting because after Sandy, we did a lot of reporting on people who wanted to bring the oyster beds back to New York Harbor. It used to be filled with mm-hmm. oyster beds as a barrier mm-hmm. against that storm coming in, you know, past the Statue of Liberty. Mm-hmm. Is the solution aquaculture? You're all shaking your heads no.
Environmentally, no, it's not the answer here.
Why not?
It doesn't restore the structure, the natural structure of the bay and the environment of the bay. When I say I would support something like that, it would be for the community, for the out-of-work oystermen to hedge their bets.
It's an economic band-aid. It'll provide some economic relief, but it doesn't fix the ecology.
Is it possible we're watching Apalachicola Bay and what happened here, the fishing industry here in this spot, maybe just leave?
These people are so tied to this area. I feel certain that
What if you can't bring it back? What if you can't do oysters? Yeah.
The reality is they probably are not going to be able to do oyster tonguing in the wild for a very long time, but they already know that.
I believe more thought should be given, especially upstream, to the way water is actually used. Big agriculture is still using spray and evaporate methods of watering their plants. Everything from car washes to watering the golf course. All of that needs to be looked at, and all of that needs to be a component of what's going on here.
That's Roy Ogles, recently retired from the Florida Department of Environmental Protection, Dr. Felicia Coleman, director of Florida State's Coast and Marine Lab, and her colleague, Dr. Sandra Brooke.
This morning, NBC aired a rerun of the Megyn Kelly Today Show, and sources are reporting that the show may be canceled. That comes after Kelly's comments on her show on Tuesday about blackface.
What is racist? Because so truly, you do get in trouble if you are a white person who puts on blackface on Halloween, or a black person who puts on whiteface for Halloween. Like when I was a kid, that was okay as long as you were dressing up as like a character.
Several of her fellow NBC stars denounced her yesterday, and she apologized. NPR TV critic Eric Deggans joins us now. Hi, Eric.
Hi.
And we should say that you are also a media analyst at NBC News, but you've never met Kelly or appeared on her show. Some of the reactions to those comments, even from people at NBC, were pretty harsh. Let's listen to Al Roker on Wednesday.
Look, the fact is, while she apologized to the staff, she owes a bigger apology to folks of color around the country, because this is a history going back to the 1830s. Minstrel shows to mean and denigrate a race wasn't right. I'm old enough to have lived through Amos and Andy, mm-hmm. Where you had white people in blackface playing two black characters with just magnifying the worst stereotypes about black people. And that's what the big problem is. And that's what the issue is.
What did you make of the response from NBC?
I think what we saw sort of illustrated the tensions within the network over her show, over the things she's been doing on the show. From the start of the morning show, there was this tension because she was having trouble adapting to the morning format. People may remember that there was an interview she did with Jane Fonda where Jane Fonda took offense at a question that she asked about her plastic surgery, I believe, and you know, there were celebrities who were hesitant to appear on the show, and the cast of Will and Grace was made uncomfortable in how she referred to the show's groundbreaking legacy of presenting gay characters on television and the impact on fans. And so there was this struggle. You know, she was struggling to adapt to the time slot, and I think people were sort of resenting how much money she was getting paid. And, you know, there were flashes where her old Fox News persona would come through mm-hmm. and it would sort of obliterate the feel-good atmosphere of a morning show. And then on top of all of that, the show was getting worse ratings than it was getting when Al Roker and Tamron Hall hosted an edition of the Today Show in that time slot. So there was a lot of tension at NBC about what she was doing and how she was performing. And I feel like this blackface incident and the way Craig Melvin and Al Roker, two African-American anchors on the Today Show, how they criticized her very pointedly. NBC Nightly News did a segment on the controversy. It just illustrated the tension that was going on surrounding her show.
And then she apologized at the start of her show on Wednesday. Let's listen to that apology.
I was wrong, and I am sorry.
One of the great parts of sitting in this chair each day is getting to discuss different points of view. Sometimes I talk and sometimes I listen. And yesterday I learned. I learned that given the history of blackface being used in awful ways by racists in this country, it is not okay for that to be part of any costume, Halloween or otherwise. I have never been a PC kind of person, but I do understand the value in being sensitive to our history, particularly on race and ethnicity.
So as we said, Eric, today NBC is airing a rerun of the program, and there are sources saying that Megyn Kelly may not return to the show at all. Do you think this is the end of her show?
I don't know that. There are indications that she's negotiating to adopt some sort of different role that would not involve hosting that time slot. I always thought it was going to be a tough turn for her because hosting a show where you're a pundit and you're being very incisive and bold and aggressive about presenting opinions about the day's news is very different than hosting a segment at 9 a.m. in the morning where you're expected to be much more friendly. You're expected to be, you know, a much more welcoming presence. And you're also, frankly, expected to appeal to a much more diverse audience than she was expected to appeal to at Fox. You know, this is a broadcaster working in daytime television where the viewership is even more diverse than it is for more conventional time slots. And, you know, I've always been surprised, by the way, that she could be so perceptive about how sexism works in society and be so tone deaf to how race works in society. And this is not the first time that she said something that's insulting about race, either on Fox or, you know, on her NBC show. But the same sort of dynamics when it comes to gender and sexism, she seems to do very well with. And so that's a disconnect that is tough to understand sometimes with her. How can you be so effective in rooting out sexism and talking about that on the air, but be so terrible at understanding the same sorts of oppressions that people of color face every day in America?
It's NPR TV critic Eric Deggans. Eric, thank you.
Thank you.
And Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young in Tallahassee. It's Here Now.